How was your Christmas break? How was your holiday break? Disgusting all well? Working hard. I got faith in you.
Thank you so much.
Right. Nice seeing you. All right. So, y'all took the exam, right? I would have liked to be able to talk about it in person, but obviously we had the snow day last week, so it is what it is. And as I've been mentioning in all my classes, weather forecast looks like we might have more inclement weather come Thursday. So what does that mean? Well, if I got to do a remote video, I'll do a remote video. But of course, if it's a late delay and we have class, then we'll be here in person. But either way, today we are going forward. Yes.
What day was the test actually open for? I took it yesterday, but it's
yesterday.
Okay. It said Sunday on it. Like it said it was due by Sunday. I don't know if it was a glitch or...
It might have been a glitch. Engage is acting wonky. So my other class was supposed to have it tomorrow, but it opened up on Saturday.
Yeah, it said it opened on Saturday and it closed Sunday.
Yeah.
I was still able to take it yesterday.
Yeah, so I don't know what's going on with Engage, but as long as you were able to take it, and y'all took it, then we're in a good place.
Engage doesn't have an issue too where they won't like show the assignments on the dashboard.
Oh, really?
So, there'll be certain assignments for just one course for that day.
Oh, you won't see anything else?
You won't see anything else.
Oh, that's tough. Well, the system itself is old and it's been a long time since it's updated, so hopefully the college will invest. You are, sir?
Jaquan,
all right, very good. Perfect. So, yeah, so I'm going to get to it. I will get them graded. Tomorrow I will be home. If we have no class on Thursday because of snow, I will be home. But you'll hear, I'll send you you'll get a notification, a ping when I grade it, and I'll open it up and let you take a look at what you did right, what you did wrong. All right, so working on the stuff for exam number two. On the video, I was talking about the fact that the significance of Vietnam was impacted by the outbreak of the Cold War. Now, the Cold War took place before my birth, but if you want to see a period where literally everything in the world was so tense that war could erupt anywhere at any time, we're talking the late 40s and 50s. You had an appearance, a desire by the United States to become the world police in order to prevent the outbreak of another World War II. But you also had adversarial forces that were interested in conquering the world. The communists, the Soviets, spearheaded by Joe Stalin, who wanted to basically destroy global capitalism and unleash the world in a communist revolutionary fire, adhering to the Leninist doctrine of making Russia the center of the earth, the dictatorship of the proletariat, and basically taking control of the earth. So, the Cold War was us trying to keep the free states free and stop the Russians. Well, unfortunately, China fell. Joe Stalin rolled his tanks into Eastern Europe. And it looked as if the Russians were going to win. And then we got involved in a war. This is the last thing I talked about. Once they seized control of China, the communists in North Korea decided they were going to push south and conquer all of Korea. And that Korea, southern tip, is only about 100 miles from the middle of Japan, a nation that we were prepared to basically defend to the end. So this was a bad, dangerous situation. And to make matters worse, if you ever have a chance to study the Korean War, it didn't start off great, and then it got really bad. The North Koreans almost successfully overran the whole country. So it looked like we were losing. So all of our attention was in Korea. And to a degree, we took the eyes off the ball in Vietnam. But the Viet Minh were prepared to use the chaos of the Korean War, the fog, to expand their hopes of reclaiming North Vietnam. Beginning in the fall 1950, seemingly all over the place in North Vietnam, the Viet Minh came out of the jungles and started striking at French positions. And a huge reality should have been obvious to the powers that be. The French aren't going to be able to win this. Because France had a armed forces based upon the weapons and the tactics utilized in the Second World War. They used mechanized transportation to move men, to move equipment, to move supplies. And in order to use mechanized equipment, you needed roads. Now, we take for granted the fact that you can get anywhere you want in our country by roads. There are thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of miles of roads going in every single direction. That was not the case in Vietnam. Vietnam was largely jungles once you get off the coast. So if the enemy is in the jungles, to get to them, you have to drive. Well, the problem is there were no roads, so what did the French have to do? They had to build roads. So essentially, they're telling the Viet Minh, guess where we're coming from, and guess how we're going to get to you. All right. Plus, the French were bound to positions, defensive positions along the road. Because if they didn't guard the roads, the Viet Minh would destroy the roads, which meant they couldn't move. So to a degree, the Viet Minh had the advantage. Now, an early example of this reality could be seen in the fall of 1950, when the French were forced to withdraw from a village near the Chinese border of Cao Bang. This was a northernmost position. It was a fortified town. They believed in true European fashion. If they had their guns there, their artillery, their tanks, their trucks, that they could basically hold the perimeter simply by being present. That's, after all, what the Germans did when they unleashed the Blitzkrieg and conquered Europe, and that's what the Americans and the Allies did when they defeated the Nazis. You'd go in and you'd take control of a town, and then you would move on and go to the next town. Well, the problem is the Viet Minh weren't in the towns. The Viet Minh were in the jungles. The only way for the French to get to Cao Bang, as you can see on this map, they actually had to build a highway. And along the highway, they had a couple of big towns that were fortified. Well, this meant the Viet Minh had free range all throughout the jungles. So they were easily able to prey upon these fixed positions. Come at them from all directions. Come at them at any time of day or night. Things got so bad, the French realized, we got to pull back. So, this picture right here is the type of road that they had to drive on coming out of the hills. Narrow, single vehicle long path. There's the cliffs, there's the jungle floor down below that they had to carelessly drive along. And when you get to the low points, because it's tropical country, and it rained, you'd end up hitting mud. You can have the greatest tank in the world you want, but if it goes into the mud, it's going to sink. So as the French were trying to withdraw their weapons, the Viet Minh essentially ambushed them. And then the French withdrew to Dong Khi, and they were ambushed again. And then they pulled back to Thet Khi, ambushed again. All the way as they were trying to withdraw. Attack after attack. Not big attacks. Guerrilla warfare. And in the end, the French would lose over 6,000 soldiers killed just trying to withdraw. And the greatest consequence, they left so many weapons behind that the Viet Minh were able to arm 2 divisions of soldiers. So this created a dynamic. The Viet Minh controlled the North and had the ability to do business across the Chinese border. Well, this goes without saying. The French had never suffered a defeat at the hand of the Vietnamese since they first pushed into Vietnam back in the Napoleonic years. Napoleon III, the 1850s. They never lost. This was horrific. And it was a huge propaganda win for Ho Chi Minh. Supposedly, this picture is actually taken of Ho Chi Minh cheering on his Viet Minh soldiers after they brutalized the French. So a weird dynamic was made. France would hold Hanoi and Haiphong, the port, but pretty much all the rest of North Vietnam would be controlled by the Viet Minh. And it was in all likelihood that the Viet Minh would attempt to overwhelm Hanoi and seize full control of the North. But in a weird twist of fate, at the beginning of 1951, change occurred. In December 1950, the French would send to Hanoi General Jean de Lettrie. De Tassinet. He was a popular commander in World War II. He had the love and respect of his men. And he was entrusted to change the game, as it were. And his timing was perfect. Because just as he arrived, Vu Nguyen Giap launched a massive assault on the French positions in the Red River Delta, driving down, hitting Hanoi frequently, and also hitting Haiphong, with the goal of basically eradicating the French presence. Radio Viet Minh announced across the airwaves to the communists that they would seize control of Hanoi by Tet, which is the equivalent of the Vietnamese New Year, which is almost the same timing of the Chinese New Year, so it's the end of January. Then they also proclaimed, once we take Hanoi, we're going to give this city as a gift to President Ho. That will be his Tet present. But unfortunately, Giap made a big mistake. De Lettrie was an imaginative commander who had battlefield experience. His predecessor was just a desk jockey. So, what De La Tri would do was exploit the fact that, fine, the Viet Minh have control of the jungles, but we have all the big guns. So what he did is he deployed his artillery in a defensive perimeter that would basically allow him to not commit ground troops to fight the Viet Minh, but just start firing artillery shell after artillery shell after artillery shell. Pound the enemy until they retreat. It was so significant that the Viet Minh would actually have to withdraw from their assault back into the jungles. And then when they pulled back, De La Tri went to work. He constructed, based on the French Maginot Line, the line of defenses that they had built to separate France from Germany prior to World War I, a defensive position known as the De La Tri Line, outlined in the red. Here's Hanoi, here's Haiphong, this is the capital, this is the major port. All along this perimeter were over 1,200 concrete bunkers. These bunkers were built to withstand direct artillery fire. So you're going to shoot a cannon at it, you're going to shoot a mortar at it, it's going to be able to resist. Each of these blockhouses would have 10 men inside. They would be clustered in groups of 3 to 6. So in the line, you'd put a couple of clusters together with the idea of fire that could basically guard the flanks of most of the positions. Although usually it was like a triangular thing to give you the angles of fire. This was spread out over 235 miles. They would also build an inner line of defenses in and around Haiphong. Because this is how the French are going to get resupplied. The ships are going to come in, they're going to offload men, materiel, bullets, and so forth. De La Tri also ordered all throughout this line roads to be built, capable of allowing 30-ton tanks to drive on. The tanks would be repositioned whenever the enemy would attack from any direction. So if the enemy's coming this way and attacking the bunkers, you move the tanks this way. If they're coming this way, you move the tanks up. But of course, as I have up here, fine, you dig in, you make strong defenses, and what does that result in? The French control. Where's the red? Where's the red? That doesn't really show up on TV. French control in the interior, the Viet Minh control the rural sectors. Questions? But here's the thing. If the Viet Minh start smashing up against the wall and smashing up against the wall and smashing up against the wall, what's eventually going to happen? The wall's going to break. And so Ho Chi Minh constantly counseled patience. Why? He knew the attitudes of the French people. He had lived in France, don't forget. He knew that the French people were fickle. They were constantly putting their fingers to the wind to see which way the wind was blowing. And if times would get tough, what have the French done over and over and over again throughout history? Surrender. They would surrender. So Ho knew if we stick this out, eventually the French will lose resolve to fight. Not even to win. Just they'll stop wanting to fight. And the moment that happens, we win. But to ensure that his own people would not give up on the fight, Ho Chi Minh would utilize all of the skills that he had gathered since he was a child. He would unleash a twofold propaganda front to keep Vietnamese resolve strong. This was a war of nationalism. This was a war for the Vietnamese people to have their own country. And it also was a clash of races. He wanted his people to be able to defeat the white foreign invaders. Because if they were able to do that, then they have their country. But you also got to watch out for the Vietnamese turncoats. Because there were a lot of Vietnamese collaborating with the French. Well, guess what? Those race traitors, they got to go. So with these two messages, because don't forget, the Vietnamese people were getting basically exploited by the French, and the vast majority of the Vietnamese were peasants, and the vast majority of the peasants hated what the French were doing, and thus they hated the Vietnamese agents that were collaborating. So, the majority of the population who hated being ruled by the French were willing to sacrifice everything for a hope of freedom. And as Ho Chi Minh once famously warned a French diplomat that he was negotiating with, and I quote, "You will kill 10 of my men for every one I kill of yours. But even at that rate, you will be unable to hold out, and victory would go to me." He was intending on making Vietnam a quagmire. He's going to suffer lots of casualties. He's going to lose lots of men. But he knew he would wear down the French resolve. Ironically, guess what they would do to us once we took over? And why was this possible? Vietnam was not a place to fight a European Western-styled war. Talk to any Vietnam veteran, and not the Vietnam era veterans. Not that I'm going to disparage their service, but under military code, anyone who served during the Vietnam era can walk around with a hat saying that they're a Vietnam veteran. So anyone who was in any branch of service from 62 all the way up to 75, they are classified as a Vietnam-era veteran. Those aren't the people I'm talking about. I'm talking about the man who were the boots on the ground in country. Combat veterans. Support veterans. My father was there for 2 years. He does not talk about the war because he actually was a combat veteran. And true men who actually engage in battle and kill don't brag about it. They're not doing that. So I know little about his experiences, other than he would say, to quote my father, "It never fucking stopped raining until it suddenly stopped. And then it was hot and dry. And then it started fucking raining again." Vietnam is full of jungles and mountains and swamps. More than half of Vietnam is basically rainforest. Plus, places like the Mekong Delta in South Vietnam, that lay below sea level from about May to October. So much water came down that way. There were monsoons. There were swamps. There was the jungles full of old growth trees that the canopy was so dense, you could be hovering over the top of the tree. You couldn't see anything down. So as a result, the Viet Minh exploiting the jungles could walk even during the day and not be seen. And unlike the Europeans, the Viet Minh would devise extraordinary ways to move men and equipment that did not rely upon roads. They literally carved paths out of the jungles and recruited porters. Just peasants who would work for food, who would, with these backpacks, literally climb up sides of mountains. And they would move anything the army needed, anywhere in Vietnam. The French, they had their trucks, they had their tanks. But can you make a tank go up the side of a mountain? Can you have a truck go through a swamp? Well, I can tell you this. Every single swamp has a point where you actually can cross it, if you know the way. But a truck? Not so good. Plus, when it rained, even the best roads would turn into mud. Ruts. You think the road's bad now with all the potholes? Imagine if they didn't have asphalt on them. Well, most of Vietnam became impassable during the rainy season. So if you are a recon platoon and you go out into the middle of the jungle during the rainy season, no one's going to be able to drive an ambulance and get you out. So, Giap and the Viet Minh would master the terrain utilizing guerrilla tactics, which would basically render French tanks in the countryside useless. Oh, I knew I had pictures of it. See, look, this one, high mountains. Dense jungles. Look at that. Look at the water table. There's water everywhere in the valley. All right. So this war, which was a precursor to our own, truly was weird. Because I got one more element that I'm going to throw at you. I keep using the phrase French. French soldiers. Well, truth be told, there were actually very few men from France fighting in the French army. Most of the units were made up of colonial troops, as pictured here. Look at this. You got one French guy, all right? You got this guy who looks like a Moroccan. You got this guy who looks like he's Asian. Could be Cambodian, could be Southern Vietnamese. This guy's right out of Africa. Oh, and he's from another friend. I think he's from Libya. Of the 200,000 men that made up the French Expeditionary Force, about 51,000 were Africans or North Africans. About 60,000 were pro-French Indonesians, so Vietnamese, Cambodians, Laotians. You had 20,000 foreign legionnaires. Ever hear of the French Foreign Legion? These were guys that would get involved because they liked fighting, like mercenaries. So who were in the French legionnaires at this time? You had former German soldiers. You had Poles. You had Hungarians. You had Spanish. You had Americans. So of the 200,000 men, only about 60,000 were actually French. So you had this snapshot of a colonial empire fighting against a bunch of people who wanted their own country. And they used rhetoric that the West had used for decades, self-determination. And why were the colonial forces fighting? To keep these people as part of the empire. It was so bizarre. Well, the reality of what was going on was not, or rather did not go unnoticed. An agent of the State Department, U.S. diplomat, Daniel H. Simpson, he was stationed in Saigon, and he was given the opportunity to go out on runs, French operations, mostly in South Vietnam. And he took notice of something. The unit that he was assigned to was made up of Moroccans, Vietnamese, and Senegalese. They had two French officers with them. They were in this motored armored cavalry unit, and they would drive out onto the roads as their orders, and they went around all of the big French plantations, the rubber plantations that existed in South Vietnam. Why? Well, it was believed that the Viet Minh were in the area. When they arrived, they were met by loyal South Vietnamese soldiers. The armored cars slowly lumbered together, making all the noise that the old diesel trucks used to make in a part of the country that had no other cars. You could hear the engines for miles around. And amazingly, they found no Viet Minh. So, after they did their patrol, they began heading back to the city. But before they left, he noticed that the South Vietnamese soldiers that were stationed there went back to their little huts, their battle stations, went back inside, unbuttoned their uniforms, were sitting there in t-shirts, took out their little cold beverages, and spent their time fanning themselves. The moment the French officers weren't watching. So Simpson, in his report back to the United States, said the following, and I quote, "I couldn't help but wonder if the Moroccans and the Algerians and the Tunisians and the black Africans and the expeditionary force weren't taking part in some huge charade. What were they really thinking? Fighting under the tricolor? So many thousands of miles from home? While the locals could fan themselves while drinking iced tea." So bizarre. Questions? Well, by early 1952, and more formalized by the beginning of 1953, the wonks, the policy wonks, the strategists that worked in all the government agencies, the CIA, the Department of Defense, the State Department, they all suddenly started realizing that the French are not going to win this war by fighting the way they are fighting. Because Vietnam has basically become a quagmire. And they didn't know how to change it. No new gun, no new plane, no new bomb is going to help convince the French to fight efficiently enough to win. So, the United States began urging the French to do three things. One, get more aggressive. Don't go out on your little cheesy little patrols. You know, use military tactics, find out where the enemy is and blow them up. Two, stop using colonial fighters and start using Vietnamese soldiers. They argued that the French should create a Vietnamese national army. Train them, equip them. Because after all, if you allow this to be a war for nationalism, Ho Chi Minh's going to get support of the whole population. But if you make this a war against communism, then you'll get the Vietnamese people to fight for them. And third, get aggressive, get a Vietnamese army. And third, create a South Vietnamese government, an actual government. So what does that mean? Use Bo Dai. If you give him a government and you give him an army, give him a cause and win. Because after all, why are the Vietnamese going to fight and die for the French, who have been brutally exploiting the country for decades? Give the people a cause. Give them their own government and fight the evils of communism. Questions? Fortunately for America, the French didn't care. The French did not share America's vision for Vietnam. They were stuck in the colonial mindset. This was our territory. We have this territory to generate resources, and we don't care about the people. And they also were convinced they could win. Because again, going all the way back to the 1850s, France won over and over again against these little Vietnamese people. So instead of the United States telling us how we're going to fight our war, instead the United States should give us more. More military aid, more money. FYI, by 1953, the United States is spending more than 40% of the cost of this war. But now the French want more. They also want the United States to promise to commit soldiers if the Chi Coms get involved. Just like we did in Korea. So, they want military, economic aid, and soldiers if the Chinese invade. Well, needless to say, the United States politicians, how are you going to win an election to the American people? Oh, yeah, we're going to spend more of your tax dollars. Oh, yeah, and we're going to send your sons over there. That's not a winning political ad. So, truth be told, the United States didn't want to make any promises like an agreement, a treaty, with the French to send soldiers. They didn't want to send soldiers at all. They weren't down for this. But here's the catch-22. At the same time, they didn't want the French to quit because they knew the French likes quitting wars. Because if the French quit, then what? Domino theory. If Vietnam falls, what's next? Indonesia? New Zealand? Australia? So, the United States decided no troops, no agreements, but we'll continue to send money and supplies. Before I forget, because I don't know if it's in my notes later, by war's end, 1954, the United States increased funding from 40% up to 70%. Why? Because the United States decided the best way to win the war is to keep the French and the Vietnamese National Army fighting. But unfortunately, this news from 1942 was not that good. So much so, I was able actually to get my hands on a newsreel. Because the weird thing about what was developing in the Indochinese War is unlike what occurred during every other war before it. During the Indochinese War, there were actually reporters there reporting live. Now, by the way, there were news stories that came out of World War II, that came out of Korea. But all of the images that Americans saw had all been created by the Department of Defense. There wasn't any real images of the battle captured. It was all staged. Because you don't want to send the horrors and realities of war. But check this out. Come on. Yeah, open up the YouTube. Come on. You're so slow. Wi-Fi's not even really working. Where is it? I couldn't get on it earlier. You want it?
Yeah.
Really? No, we gotta watch the ad first. Come on. Skip the ad. Oh, nice. We can skip the ad. That's awesome.
Through the jungles of Indochina, French paratroopers fall back from the Black River as hordes of communist rebel forces strike hard along the 100-mile front. This is perhaps the fiercest onslaught yet directed by the Viet Minh, and French troops welcome a brief respite from the savage battle. Despite enemy fire on its mission of mercy. Unfortunately, the helicopter leaves the battlefront, but soon it will return to pick up more of the wounded. In the meantime, the French move forward to strike again at the Viet Minh terrorists.
So you're sitting at home in your country. Going to the movie theaters, which, by the way, people used to do. Back during this time, you'd go to the movie theater, typically on Saturday, and you'd be there all day. Because what you'd do is, for single price, you would get a major movie, you'd also get cartoons, and you'd get newsreels. So you'd go and spend a ticket, and you might be there for 5 hours. But imagine there, you don't even know where this place is, but suddenly you see an image of war, what's going on. And did you hear what the commentator was saying? That basically the French are getting their asses kicked. That they're being attacked by overwhelming numbers of the enemy. And they're coming at them from all directions. And that the men are tired, that they're exhausted. During 1952 alone, France suffered 90,000 casualties. The French were basically, every time they tried going out, both north, well, actually all north, central, and south Vietnam, every time they went out to the countryside, they were driven back to the cities. Bao Dai was an incompetent, corrupt buffoon that showed no skill or desire to actually lead his country, to lead his army, to hopefully defeat the communists. In Ho Chi Minh, his influence is growing. It looks like the war is coming to an end. Questions? 1952 was also an interesting year over here. Because guess what happens every 4 years like clockwork? We have a presidential election. The incumbent, Harry S. Truman, by 1952, he was unpopular and he had health concerns. So he decided not to run. Now, he became president when FDR died in 1945. He ran for his own term in 1948. But because the 22nd Amendment had not been passed yet, which creates the two terms, he could have ran again and continued to run. But he decided he was not FDR and he was not going to run again. So, there was a presidential battle between the Republican candidate, Dwight D. Eisenhower, and the Democrat candidate, Adlai Stevenson. And you want to talk about a whopping. Ike got 442 electoral votes. Stevenson only got 89. Complete blowout. Landslide. Why? Well, Ike was an American hero. He was in the image of many of the great presidents that we've had going all the way back to George Washington. He was a military man with an exemplary military career. He was one of only 9 men to rise to the rank of 5-star general. During World War II, he was supreme Allied commander of all European forces. After the war, he became Army Chief of Staff under Truman. And he was the first head of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Unblemished career. And you know something? Americans like winners. Plus, he also had the added advantage that very few candidates who have ever run for president have. In his various capacities, he worked with many of the leaders in the free world. And I love this picture because there's Churchill right there, there's Ike, and there's Joseph Stalin. He negotiated the end of World War II. He was there. So he knew all the moves were, who all the players were, and he commanded their respect. So the American people trusted him. So much so, they made fun slogans like, I like Ike. That included cartoon commercials for the kiddos.
Well, I should have left YouTube up. I knew it was coming. Come on. Come on, YouTube.
Democrats. When he got into the office, he was similar to how Trump is today. He overshadowed everything. And he was not only a household name, but there was no other political figure in the United States that could rival him. What does this mean? He had full ability to set the policies without any political conspiracies or political games. So, that being said, what was his view on Vietnam? Well, he knew that he needed to get the highest level of expertise to help him set the policy for how we were going to deal with the quagmire that was becoming Vietnam. So in that, he would tap for his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles. Sorry, I realized I didn't print out. So I gotta work off my laptop, but that's okay. All right, there we go. Bum, 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 bum. Who was Dulles? Well, Dulles was the leading expert on all events in the Pacific at the end of World War II. He, for example, drafted the Treaty of San Francisco, which was the treaty that officially ended the war in the Pacific. This was the treaty which Japan would sign and essentially unconditionally surrender. He also was responsible for drafting what is known as the U.S.-Japanese Security Treaty, which would formalize the alliance that exists between us and Japan that's still in place today. And he also was responsible for ANZUS, which is the Australian, New Zealand, and United States Security Pact. So, he knew everything that was going on in the region. That's why he was selected. Now, both Ike and Dulles were Cold Warriors. And when they came into the office, they remained committed to the containment doctrine that was devised by the Truman administration. But they would seek to modify it a bit. First, they accepted Truman's Cold War assumptions. Essentially that the United States is in danger of communist expansion. That if the United States did not step in, there would be a domino effect that would eventually get to the coasts of America itself. So, action had to be taken to prevent it. But, interestingly enough, unlike Truman, who was prepared to push, and of course the pushing culminated in the Korean War, Ike and Dulles were fearful of escalation. Meaning, they were prepared to fight the Cold War, but they didn't want the Cold War to turn into a hot war. Because imagine what would happen if the Soviet Union and the Chi-Coms made an alliance and basically went to world against the free world, like the Nazis and the Italians and the Japs did. They also were worried about the U.S. being the world's police. If you haven't gone global, if you haven't traveled abroad, you have no idea how big the Earth is. This is a big planet. And there's lots of people. And there's lots of places. How could you expect the American taxpayers to pay for military preparedness everywhere on Earth at the same time? They knew if they tried, they would eventually run out of bullets. And you can't fight a war if you run out of bullets. So, how do you counter this and still maintain a position of strength? Very simple. Dulles would devise two new doctrines which would transform the nature of the Cold War. The first, brinkmanship. Little Super Dulles down there would essentially use tactics of fear and intimidation to make the opposing side back down by essentially playing a game of chicken. The goal was to push your opponents almost to the virtual brink of total war in hopes that they would blink and back off. They did this politically. They did this in terms of military expansion, economic aid. They kept pushing, pushing, pushing. Because why? Who in their right mind would risk a total war when maybe at the last minute you try negotiating, coming up with a compromise? That's what most people do. Well, how are you going to get people to sit down and negotiate? Well, that's the second part of their doctrine. Mutual assured destruction. The United States had the largest nuclear arsenal on Earth. They publicly said over and over and over again that in the event of attack on U.S. soil or against U.S. interests, the United States would retaliate in a massive fashion by using force disproportionate to the actual attack. So, you come at me with a fist, I'm going to stab you with my knife. You come at me with a club, I'm pulling out my shotgun. You have an AR, I'm going to run you over with my truck. You let the enemy know that you are freaking crazy and you are going to completely destroy them. Because again, who in their right mind is going to risk it? That's just insane. So, Dulles believed that as crazy as Stalin was, by the way, Stalin would die, I think, at 53, none of his successors were as crazy as Stalin. Plus, they did not believe that the Soviet Union had the capacity to keep up. So yes, by this time, the Soviet Union had the bomb, but they didn't have as many bombs as the United States did. And let's not forget, who's the only country in world history ever to use the bomb to win a war?
Us.
Damn straight. Because we're crazy Americans. Almost done. Got one last little bit and then we'll be done for the day. So, what does all this have to do with Vietnam? Well, when the new administration came in, believing in the domino theory, they decided that they were going to remain committed to achieving an overall victory in Indochina. Now, I tried getting audio for this, but I couldn't find it. Ike actually let the American people know this. Because during the State of the Union, 1954, President Eisenhower actually proclaimed the following. And I quote, "Communist aggression continues to meet in Indochina with the vigorous resistance of France and the Associated States, assisted by timely aid from our country. France is holding the line of freedom in Indochina against a calculated assault of communist aggression. Well, I shall ask Congress to authorize continued material assistance to hasten the successful conclusion of the struggle in Indochina. This assistance will also bring closer the day when the Associated States may enjoy independence already assured by France. Military assistance must be continued, and technical assistance will be maintained." He's announcing to the American people, we're in on this. But the funny thing is, he also agreed with the assessment of the Truman administration that this is a quagmire. That the French are incompetent buffoons. Why? Because they're not fighting the war the right way. They're not inspiring the people to fight in South Vietnam for their own country. And they refuse to recognize, imperialism, colonies, those days are done. So, he's publicly telling the American people, we're in on this. But to the French, he says, yo, follow what Truman said. Fight more aggressively. Expand the abilities of the South Vietnamese army. And give Bo Dao, create a stable government. But here is the last click. So he says one thing to the American people. He says something else to the French. But what did he really believe? Well, in a letter to his one of his friends, he basically said, the only way the French can win this is if he gives Vietnam independence. Because if you give them independence, you essentially deflate Ho Chi Minh's argument. And, I quote, if France does not, nothing could possibly save the effort in Indochina. And continued U.S. assistance would amount to pouring our money down a rat hole. He knew the days of just pumping money was coming to an end because the money was not going to result in a win. What would the French do? Well, we're going to have to wait and see that on Thursday. So, as I said to everybody that was here early, which is most of you, don't know what it's going to bring weather-wise on Thursday. So, if we do have a snow day, I'll do another video. And like I did for the first one. Wait, did I do that game with you? Did I offer you guys extra credit if everybody watched it? No, that was your other class. Your class, I think I let you do it till like yesterday, I think. I gave you plenty of time to watch.
Well, yeah, you gave us until Monday, yeah. That's what I meant by that.
What?
You gave us
until before class. Yeah. Well, I figured you had all weekend to do it. At some point, you're going to watch it. All right, so this time I'll spice things up a little bit because I can check the analytics. I can tell who watches the video and for how long you watch the video. If I can get 95% of the class, which is like all of you but one, to watch it all the way through, I'll add extra points into your average. All right?
Hey, I would listen to the audio that was sent in email. Does that count? I didn't watch the actual video. I listened to it.
You can listen to it. That's fine. Did you stream it on YouTube or did you watch it from my website? I'll listen to it from my website.
From your website. I got it.
Okay. No.
Bumblebee. Okay.
This time I want you to watch it.
Does it still count from this last time?
I'm not doing that last time. I'm saying this one. Hey, I get to mix things up. I get to make my life interesting and make your life interesting. Well, you could still listen to it if you've got the YouTube playing.
I guess. Yeah. All right.
Bye, guys and gal.
Oh, thank you. Oh,